The Muskie 360 Podcast is brought to you by Yeti, built for the wild, Evinrude E-Tech Outboards, Joe Booker Outdoors, the number one name in Big Fish products, and The Muskie Show.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast. I've got a hot young angler from the North Woods of Wisconsin. His name's Joe Booker, I believe. Is that correct? Is that how you pronounce your name? Is it Booker?
Yeah, that's you know, it's funny. When I was young, they butchered my name.
Oh, no, they still intended. Do.
they still do.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, it's funny. It's funny all these years later. But, you know, B-U-C-H is German, so it's Buch.
Gotcha.
Booker, you know, and it's funny, though. Yeah, so, you know, I appreciate you introducing me as a young angler. It seems like it was just yesterday I was a young gun in this business, you know, and just starting out and doing this, you know, getting this guide business going up here in northern Wisconsin and you know, guiding walleyes and then trying to sneak a guy and try to talk a guy into an afternoon of muskie fishing.
Begging, and, yeah.
Well, and now look what's happened to the sport. Eh?
That's the thing. You might be the youngest at heart angler on the water, because me and Chaz were talking on the last episode sort of about just how hard you go. You know, I'm sure you've listened to it. We were talking about those French River trips where you're going up and, you know, sleeping on the boat and stuff. And we were like, man, neither of us are as hard as nails as you are. So.
Well, you know, it's funny. I appreciate that. But at the same time, you know, the body ages. And as you know, I'm hitting my mid 60s here. It's a challenge just to be in the boat with you young guys all day long and stick with you. My first trip with Chaz and my, you know, now we've been at it together for 6 years or so. And, you know, he always, you know, about 3 days into the trip, you know, on a tough afternoon or something, he was looking, he goes, dude, you just stay at it, man. You just grind it out. And I think it's important for folks to realize that is, you know, I do this seminar quite often where I talk about the things that make you successful, what really makes an elite angler. And I'm not even putting myself in that category, but I'm doing is answering
okay.
this question.
If you're not an elite angler, who is? Okay.
Well, you know, here's the thing is, you know,
right.
I've always said there's these three things you need to be an elite angler to really get dialed in. And one is knowledge, you know, knowledge of the fish, knowledge of the water. You've heard me say this before.
Absolutely.
And then it's skills is number two. So knowledge and skills. Okay.
Right.
So, but if you have the knowledge and you have the skills, but you don't have the third element, effort.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have the effort. So think about this, folks. You take any one of those three away and you've got problems. Even these guys that have really got it down, you know, over time, if they're physically have a problem, you know, because they're getting older or and they have the knowledge, they can go out in short spurts and still be successful. But if you want to be successful at muskie fishing, you still, you know, effort is still vital. And that's why even, you know, the guys who are one method mics, so to speak, you know, in which we have a ton of them in the muskie. And that's really what you and I are going to talk about today is these guys, you know, the big thing today is even they walk through these muskie shows or they go to the muskie shop and they buy some stuff and, you know, you can pretty much predict what they're going to buy. They're going to buy, you know, five or six different colors of blades. And so if you don't want to grow as an angler, and just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you'll still do okay if you put forth the effort and you know the water.
Well,
but there's going to be those times when you just are not going to score because you haven't expanded your skill level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's why I was picking on you about being the young gun, because I mean, you know, you sit here and you've obviously changed your game. One thing that you know, definitely want to talk about it's like, you know, some of the downsizer rods and stuff like that you've used and the growth spurt. But I mean, you've been doing this for so long and a lot of people used to box, correct?
That's right.
You know, so, you know, you're rugged and tough. And a lot of, I think this growth and stuff that people need to do as an angler is not about being the toughest, the biggest and the baddest. I think it's about being a smart angler. Would you think that's a correct?
Absolutely. But you know what? You know what?
Yeah.
That does hit on a point that you know we should briefly touch on is one of the keys to staying in shape as you get older is eating correctly, staying in shape, staying physically in shape, mm-hmm. but then eating correctly when you're, you know, when you're on these trips too, you know, eating junk food.
You know, and, I'm you laughing. Know, back there eating cookies.
Well, you know, you've got to eat good. And when you get older, if you don't stay in shape and eat good, you're a goner. You won't make it. You know, you'll burn out. It was, you know, before we move any further, I remember taking a guy out from, I'd meet this guy at the sports show. He was a sponsor back then from Flambeau, mm-hmm. Flambeau products, Flambeau decoys, Flambeau. I had a hunting show and a fishing show back in that day.
Right.
And he was the sponsor of the hunting show with all the decoys, and he was sponsor of the fishing show with all of the tackle boxes and accessories they made. And he, you know, he'd see all these pictures of these big muskies, you know, and he was a ardent hunter and he was an ardent fisherman. And he says, I want to get one of these. And I says, no. And he says, it's a lot of work, man. You know, mm-hmm. the way I catch these fish is through a lot of times is through attrition.
Yeah.
You know, and you just keep, it's like that football game where, you know, everybody keeps punting, that both teams keep punting, and, you know, then it becomes a field position game. And mm-hmm. then eventually late in the game, you know, somebody wears down and you score and you win.
Yeah.
You know, by small, and that's how you win a lot in muskie fishing. But anyways, wrapping up that story is this guy about three days in on one of these really bad trips. You know, it was one of those like French mm-hmm. River, Lac Seul things. And he hasn't caught a fish in 3 days and neither have I, you know, and he's like, he sits down in the back of the boat and, you know, he pours a thermos of coffee, sits back and just starts, he kicks back and folds his legs up and he relaxes. I said, he's shaking his head. I said, how's it going, Chris, back there? He says, I'm done.
He really?
Says, Chris, we got 3 days to go. He says, I'm done.
Oh, God.
I'm done. I says, what do you mean? He says, I'm going to book a flight out of here tonight. I don't know how you can do this. You know, I don't know how you can do this day after day, hour after hour.
Right.
It's really amazing, okay? How, you know, this has happened to you, it's happened to me, you know, it's in your career when all of a sudden there's like, you know, it's just like this slap in the face moment. So he's sitting back, sipping on the coffee, shaking his head, you know, thinking about how he's going to get on an air flight out from, you know, Kenora, Ontario.
good luck.
And he's not fishing.
Right.
So that lure's not wet. That lure's not wet. You have no chance, folks.
Yeah.
Okay. The next spot.
Of course.
Put the trolling motor down. You know, we're finishing up on the third day of terrible fishing, high winds, northeast, you know, northeaster, which is mm-hmm. even worse, and water temperature dropped and nothing happened. And, you know, he's sitting back there with his legs crossed and shaking his head and trying to stay warm. But boom, I catch one fish 53 inches.
Oh, that'll do
one fish. Yeah. And you know, he netted it and he just went, you know, he was just like, wow. I said, and that fish ended up on those tackle boxes for years
mm-hmm.
that Flano was, you know, those big, square open like toolbox systems they had, you know, with the slots in them.
Oh my God. I didn't know that fish
that's on that flambeau.
Are you kidding
photo
me?
That he shot that photo on that.
I'll
trip.
Be that. That's I had no clue because you're talking about the Plano big games. It looked like a big game.
I have a dozen of them.
Oh my God. That's
and, yeah. You know how many fish we caught that trip?
One. Dude, it's a little bit of a tangent there, but you sort of hit on something too that I wanted to pick on anyway. Is like, I remember a couple years walking through camp on Eagle, and I talked to these guys coming up from the ramp, right? And they're like, man, we haven't seen anything, haven't caught anything, we're having a tough trip. And I walk by their cabin and I look over and I'm dumbfounded by the amount of empty Molson cans and bottles beside the place.
Yeah.
And I went, you know, that's one of these things of effort of like, you know, people are always asking what's to do, you know, what's this, what's that. It's like when you're going out there, you know, or we're going to Canada and doing this stuff, we're not going up there and partying. It's up with the sun and getting sleep. And, you know, it's not a party. It's a mission, you know.
Steve, How many times have we, you and I, because we do music together, by the way, folks, Steve is my buddy. We, you know, in the music thing, we, all the music you hear on my television show, that's Stephen Paul and Joe Booker. And we have a ton of fun doing that. Oh, yeah. But every time we go to the lodge, everybody wants us to play.
Yeah.
And we're like, we got to give up fishing to do that.
No way.
No way. No way.
Dude, we eat like they just released us from a prison. Like Joe Booker has table manners until he gets to Canada. You're great. Think about the guru. I mean, if it's like watching a raccoon open a trash bag is the way Tyler eats. He's shoving it in his face so we can get up there as quick as possible. It's a travesty. His mother should have raised him better, but that's, you know, we're trying to get out of there.
It's a good thing his mother doesn't hear these podcasts. Oh, you know, but you know, it's important to realize, folks, that no matter how much you musky fish and what you're throwing out there, you know, there's more to the sport though than just fishing. And we're talking about fishing hard, and that's one of the three elements. And the other one is learning water, but the one we really want to concentrate on is growing your game today. And Steve, you and I talked right before we went on the air that, you know, this has really been one of the things that made me start Musky Hunter magazine. This is one of the things that triggered me to do seminars and write all these years about muskies, because the vast majority of musky anglers, even today, you know, they get dialed in on one or two lures and that's it.
Yes.
And they'll fish it in different colors. You know, they'll fish it fast, they'll fish it slow, but they're, you know, it's like, you know, primarily a lot of these guys just fish blades. They just fish blades or blades in topwater. But maybe now they have a third bait and then they're fishing rubber. So, you know, maybe. But a lot of these guys, you know, they're just blades. Well, let's try different. I know a lot of guides like that.
Oh, yeah.
They're just fish different size blades, different colors, different retrieves, but that's all they fish. And they'll pick up a topwater lure, you know, under the right, what they think is the right conditions. But man, they never throw a crankbait. You know,
they
never throw anything else. And you know, the episode we're going to air this weekend is really a unique. It's such a unique example. The biggest muskie, listen to this, folks. Mm-hmm. The biggest muskie I caught last year, the biggest one, was bigger than the Titan, you know, the Wisconsin Titan I caught.
Uh-huh.
It was bigger than any of these other fish we feature so far. It was caught on the smallest, most diminutive lure that we make. You know, the JB Rattler. Most anglers aren't even, they don't even have it in their box.
Right, they're not even thinking that.
They're not even thinking that. I know you fish them
well,
a lot.
Well, and the thing you just said about that, I've been racking my brain about the baits, and it's like, I think what people get trapped in is you get stifled by early success. You know, the first thing, I mean, if you were taking me out and I'd never musky fished before, you're going to stick me on blades. And so you get early success with blades and you just keep going back to the trough because you don't have confidence in this other stuff.
You're absolutely right. You know, those who listen to the podcast that are deer hunters, it's the same thing with tree stands and, you know, stand sites. It's like, I'm going back to that tree stand because that's the one I've shot my buck off. You know, it's the same scenario.
What hill are you going to die on? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and, you know, life's like that. You know, they buy the same vehicle and they, you know, they eat the same food and they throw the same lures. And I guess, you know, if these folks get anything out of our podcast today, I think it's, you know, beyond effort, it's you know, when things are tough, you've got to dig in the box and do some things differently, you know, and that's what makes you grow as an angler. That's where you will grow as an angler.
Mm-hmm. Like,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. As far as like, if you were going to take someone that's like sort of caught in that trap that they're only doing, say they're doing blades and top raiders, that's such a common thing, right?
Yes.
Like what's your recommendation? How do you force that growth? Like, how do you, because I see it happen all the time with clients where it's like, I force them to throw this bait. It's like, put on this shallow raider, put on this crane bait, put on whatever. And you see them light up. Like, I've never caught a crankbait fish and it's amazing. But if they're forced to do it, let's say it's a guy, he's not, you know, he's fishing by himself up there. Like, how do you sort of break your day up, or when do you force that? Like, how do you force that growth?
I want to approach this from two angles. One is, and I do this, by the way, myself all the time, still do it. And I do it whether I'm bass fishing, you know, I'm walleye fishing or I'm musky fishing. I do this. Okay. I will purposely, when I know I'm on fish, I will purposely put the hot lure down and force myself to improve my game on what I'm weak at.
Oh yeah.
And I'll give you a classic example that has now really worked into my musky game, for example, is I was weak on the bass fishing end. This is going back a few years, but I was weak on the jig game on the big, you know, rubber leg swim jig game.
These swim jigs are deadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, every time I got into a spot where I thought was a good, shallow water bite, I'd throw a spinner bait. You know, that was just, that's the bass fisherman in me. So, I got onto a really good bite and, I could just see the fish in front of me and they were just smashing spinner baits. And I thought, what a great time with a guest in the boat is to give him the spinner bait. And now I put the swim jig on and see, let him catch some fish because he's a guest on my TV show.
Right.
And now, let's see if I can improve my game. And I have really done well doing that. Now, taking that in the musky game, take the lure you're weak at, folks, and force yourself to fish it over spots you know have got fish on it, and take some time, spend some hours at it. They're not wasted hours. They're absolutely not wasted time and hours, because if you dial that lure in even a little bit and start to score on it, you will get that thing that Steve just talked about. You will get the confidence thing that you need to keep going. Now, saying that, I want to approach the same thing from a different direction, is that the one of the key times to put the blades away, and Chaz and I opened this show that we're going to airs on Friday, starts on Friday after at lunchtime, is what do we talk about is this lipless crankbait, along with these little small divers like the shallow raider style lures and the depth raider, which you and I featured the last couple of weeks on show too, big pike and muskies, is that they are most deadly when what you're throwing doesn't work. The guy with that lacks confidence continues to stick with, grind it out, keep fishing what you know and what you're good at. And I know there's that philosophy and then eventually that scores in some situations. But honestly, when you fish, if you fish alongside somebody else, and where I'm leading with this now is I had the guru, and Mr. Tyler Andrews and the dude in the boat fishing blades. Okay. So I got two good anglers fishing blades over, kind of fishing perpendicular over these shallow flats. And I'm up on the bow going, well, I don't know why I should fish blades. I got to fish something else because these two knuckleheads are fishing blades and they're both good fishermen. So why should I take a fish away from them? And, when we're in a filming situation also, I just want to fish in the boat to get on camera. Do I want to catch it? Yeah. But I want, especially, you notice that, Chaz is he never gets excited when he hooks one.
No, he's not flipping out. It's the first one he's ever seen,
and the dude gets—I mean, the guru gets downright depressed when he doesn't catch it. So I thought, handing out Valium on that boat. Exactly, but when you're fishing with two blade guys, okay? Now these guys are not moving fish on blades all morning.
Yeah,
and I've been throwing some jerk baits in front of them, and I'm not moving fish. And where I'm going with this is, and we intro this particular segment like this, you go, this bait, I'm pointing at this little JB Rattler. I said, this bait really excels when these other baits, and I point to other baits, when they fail. And so here, here's the scenario. When you're fishing these fish in really in that 6-7 foot of water or less, it can work in deep water, especially when it's clear bone. You're fishing 6 feet of water and less. And you got blades already out there. You got topwater and blades, or blades and something else, another popular shallow water technique. You got your partners fishing that stuff. You know that, and they're not scoring on fish. They're not seeing fish. We weren't scoring on fish. We weren't seeing fish. And when we get to that point, that is that same scenario that I have written about, talked about. It's all over Muskie 360. I talk about, it's on one of my latest vlogs. I talk about, you've got those chasers / followers, and you got those ambushers. Now, when you have chasers / followers, those fish are following those blades. They're following those topwater lures. So, you know, that you don't need, I'm not saying you won't catch a fish on a crankbait at that time or a jerkbait, but when they're not following those baits, that is when you need to force yourself to put on the new lure that you're not confident in, that you've now seen other guys catch fish on, and put some hours on that bait and see if you can't get, you know, score on a fish. And you will learn that, like I have over years, is that, you know, the crankbait, holy cow, you know, it serves a double purpose. I can really follow points and turns and the contour of a spot by fishing a crankbait in front of the boat nice. And I also, so I've got kind of the side scanning, you know, side imaging sonar, so to speak. I always know what's in front of me so I can adjust my boat control, but I've also got it. I'm throwing a bait out there that nobody else is throwing.
Yeah.
And that takes me to one more thing. And I think this is really vital in our podcast today, folks. If you fish waters that get a lot of traffic,
right,
this is where you can win the game.
Yeah.
You know, you can come in from behind folks a lot. And you know, when you're fishing a busy, you know, this particular fish that we're going to air this weekend, it's busy early July peak time on Lake of the Woods, as it is in northern Wisconsin, as it is in most places. 4th of July week, plus or minus 4th of July week, is the peak traffic on almost every lake in North America. And that's not, you know, and that's also on Lake of the Woods, and everybody's throwing blades and everybody's throwing topwater on Lake of the Woods. So how do you beat them? You know, fishing something weird like the JB Rattler, you know, and finally, you know, and I know I'm motor mouthing here today, but I'm excited.
That's great.
You know, but so cool, Steve, is that one of the biggest misnomers about the JB Rattler and these small crankbaits is that, well, they're not a big fish bait. You know, they're too small.
Right. Most, you're only going to catch dinks on that.
Yeah. So,
wrong.
So here we go. The biggest two muskies of my July trip. The biggest muskie of the August trip you and I took were both caught on little crankbaits.
Yep. That's it. it's the one thing too, and I would point out, and I know it's not a sales pitch but I can say it, is like when you're looking at rattle traps and stuff, the thing about the JB Rattler is the construction, how it's built. Because I was hesitant in the past, especially spending so many years back in the day on Cave Run as a kid, you know, fishing March Madness and into April, May and stuff with crankbaits or with rattle traps. We used to run into, like, they didn't have the strength to hold big fish. And that's the one thing. If you're hesitant on rattle traps, the JB Rattlers, actually, you've beefed that up when you guys made bait.
Yes. You know what's interesting about that? Did you notice, you know, when you've got a company that's been in business as long as ours has, and any of these other companies that are in business, you know, the length of time that ours is, you become trendsetters.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at, for example, let's be honest, the Booker Tail, the original Booker Tail 700 is the frame, the way it's put together.
Absolutely.
You know, is the most copied lure in history.
You have the most copied paint jobs too, but that's a whole
That's true. But the Booker Tail 700, and, you know, right from the brass bodies and the bead setup, it's the most copied lure. The way we have the hook in it, it's the most copied lure in history. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, that's, you can call that a compliment of sorts, you know, because when you build something that's good, people are on it. Now,
right,
taking that into the muskie game, we were definitely not the first to do a bigger lipless crankbait.
Right.
But what I think is interesting is that, outside of the southern game, the Kentucky-Tennessee game that you're totally dialed in on, and you and the guys down there are and have been before anybody up here was, it was considered the lipless crankbait was considered a southern bait in the spring, and nobody threw them outside that. But now, all these other companies are starting to build lipless and sell lipless crankbaits. You've seen them. You mentioned to me maybe 3 weeks ago, hey, you know, there's another bait out there that looks just like a J.B. Rally. Well, basically, that's what happens when you have success. And you know, and the J.B. Rattler really is, you know, what we – basically that lure is Cotton Cordell's original hot spot. That was the original mold. That was Cotton Cordell's original mold. And and so, you know, yeah, we just, you know, we put a little bit heavier hardware on there. And, of course, you know, heavier split rings and then heavier hooks. And, you know, that's interesting. We should talk about that just briefly here is one of the things we do – do with this with these little lipless crankbaits and a little depth rater. You and I've done this a lot too, with little depth rater, is we oversize the hooks. And Chaz and I hit on it on our intro on this thing coming up this weekend with this big fish. Chaz nicknamed, you know, he nicknames all my big fish. You know, he nicknamed, you know, the Titan, you know, he nicknamed the what's the big one that we, you know, we caught a few years ago.
Goliath. Anyways,
he nicknames Goliath. He nicknamed Goliath. Chaz comes up with all those names.
Right.
And he nicknamed this fish Balboa.
Balboa.
So we already have a nickname for this fish. So that when Balboa hits the air this weekend, you guys kind of had a prelude on that. But anyways, we talk about, you know, upsizing these trebles. And one of the things that we've had great success with, if you fish these baits out of the box, whether it's a J.B. Rattler or something similar, more often than not, the factory puts them together as a bass lure. And for smaller, lighter rods in reels and lighter tackle, and they just don't handle a big fish. You hook them, but you know, in a long battle, you end up a couple head thrashes and they just rip free and they swim away.
Right.
And what we learned is that if you go, which you upside, you go to short shank, upsize treble hooks, and you seem to hold these fish, you know, long, you know, better at these big fish. And, you know, you and I have done the same thing with shallow raiders and the 5-inch and the 6-inch shallow raider and depth raider is going to 3-aught hooks on them. And boy, you know, when those small lures have big needle sharp trebles on them, big sharp trebles on them, they can't, they're all hooks and they can't get off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing though, is like, you're talking about out of the pack. It's a great bait, but you know, it's don't be afraid to modify, you know,
right.
I mean, it's one of those deals. I actually think if not trying to speak out of turn here, but if they sold like the J.B. Rattler with the hooks that we throw it on there with, like people wouldn't, they would be like, that's more hook than bait. It would look weird.
You know? It does look weird. Yes. The way we fish
but
it,
don't be
it
afraid of that, weird. You know?
Well, you know, it's interesting how oversizing, you know, most of the tournament bass fishermen do this with when they're on a big fish bite with these, you know, with bass sized crankbaits, when they're a big fish bite, you know, they go to an oversized treble. Now, one of the keys, folks, we've talked about this even in vlogs, as soon as you upsize or oversize your trebles, shorten up the shank of the hook. So as soon as you, if you're using a 2-aught and you go to a 3-aught, you know, you have 2-aught and you had a long shank, you need to go 3-aught or 4-aught, and you need to choose a hook model that is a shorter shank. And then even though the hook looks maybe a little bit too big for the lure, it will all still function. The other thing that's kind of neat about oversized trebles on these crankbaits, Steve, and you know this, is that they vibrate tighter.
Yes.
They track better and vibrate tighter. So if you want to fish them fast, you know, they are not going to track left or right when them bigger hooks are sitting underneath, because you got more keel weight.
Yeah, just drag, absolutely, under that bait, yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, there's so many we could sit here, and I know we don't need to crawl down the hook rabbit hole too much further because we'll go for days, but how do you feel about facing down some user questions?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. You know, we have such a wonderful following on Muskie 360, and it's growing by leaps and bounds, and it's exciting. You know, it's you created a monster, Steve.
Yeah, well, awesome. We're having fun with it, and we got we'll throw some of these your way. Save me and Chaz. a few dozen extra questions here.
Well, I won't be as entertaining as you and Chaz, but I'll do the best I can.
We're doing this earlier in the day than me and Chaz do ours, if you can figure that out. That's why we're far more, we're a little bit looser by the time me and Chaz are doing these things. So the first one up is John C. John C. says, I am right-handed and I cast with my right hand and then switch the rod to my left and start reeling. Okay, so would it be better to get a left-handed reel and just cast from the right and reel with my left hand?
Well, I think both of us can answer it because
I'm a lefty.
You're a lefty.
Are you a lefty? You're the same. No, we're both left-handed.
Okay.
And I think we've broached it different. You reel with your left, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I am a lefty.
Yeah.
That uses what the industry calls a right-handed reel.
Yeah.
But see, what my argument is that
that's probably why I broke your rod in Canada, because we're casting on the same side.
Gosh, that was exciting.
Great moment in sports. Things.
It's one of the great moments. You look at each other and go, you know, we're still friends.
the fact I wasn't strangled right there on the boat.
You know, but you know what? Here's the thing. Now, John's question is, he a lefty or a right?
He says, I am right-handed. So he's casting right-handed. Okay.
Yep.
He's doing what everybody else does. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. What I taught myself to do, and John, I'm not saying that you should do this because we're going to give you two answers here. One's from Steve and one's from me, because we both have approached this a little bit different. I have I'm left-handed, so I've taught myself to cast bait casting gear with my left hand. Mm-hmm. And that way I never have to switch hands. And my power arm is my left arm. And I play guitar, you know, with the right-handed guitar. So I cast the same way. So, but when I'm fishing spinning gear, if you watch some of my old bass fishing episodes with spinning gear, I'm fishing with the right hand. So I taught myself to fish with both, so I don't have to switch hands. That being said, either teach yourself to cast left-handed with the present gear you have, or do what Steve does and go ahead, Steve.
Well, the thing is this, is in retrospect, if I could go back to 1985 and start over, I would have done it your way. But because I think the biggest takeaway is the power hand, because it actually took me we're the same scenario where I'm a true left-hander, but I play guitar right-handed as well. So you have, and I'm not trying to get a far afield for muskie fishing. Our dominant hands when we're playing a guitar, your dominant hand is on the neck, so you have the most dexterity there. And what it is like, let's say the way I fish is my rod's in my right hand, I reel with my left. It would be smarter to have the rod in your dominant hand, because it'd be easier to present articulated cadences and things that are going to be in time with your what I would call your good arm, your dominant arm.
Yep.
And you're going to have more power where, you know, I've trained mine, and I'm borderline ambidextrous on some level, because I can switch back and forth. You know what I'm saying? Like you're saying, but you know, I've been doing it for so long where that's the way. So I would agree with you. I think the best way is to have the rod in your dominant hand and keep it there.
Yes. If John is right-handed and that's his dominant hand, maybe he's better off
with a left-handed reel.
With a left-handed reel. But me being, you know, that my left arm is my dominant arm, casting with traditional bait casting gear, you know, I don't have to switch hands.
That's what I would get. That's the biggest thing is I watch these dudes.
And I have more options.
Oh, I watch these. Yeah, you have. Well, that's the problem is, like, how many times have I called you and complained about reels?
Right.
Like, I'm not knocking any reels, but left-handed reels 99% of the time are crummier than right-handed reels. It's like,
and they're just not available.
No, that's why I fish those roundaboos, because that's like the most common left-handed reel. So, you know, if you want to be different and weird, you can fish like I do. But I like what you're saying is keep it. Just don't switch hands. I think that's the biggest thing.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the major, vast majority of anglers that I hang around, including Dickie and the dude, they both cast right-handed, switch in the air, and you know they make the switch, so they're doing it successfully, and so I'm good with that. The only argument I have with that, and I've talked about this in vlogs and everything else,
hot
is that
blades.
Yeah, if you are switching in midair, unless you totally get that coordination and synchronization dialed in, you're going to have a lure that hits the water and a momentary sinkage, and it, you know, before you get the hand switch and get engaged, unless you master mid-air hand switch. You have to, when I mean mid-air, while the lure is still in the air, you have to change hands while the lure is in the air. It changed, you know, the reel from one hand to the other. To me, it's kind of goofy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I just don't do it that way. I totally concentrate on the performance of the cast. There's no switching from the moment the lure is released to the moment the lure gets to the boat and the figure eight there. And then I can just disengage the free spool and make the next cast. There's just no, and that's why you switched and do things your way with the right hand, because you don't want to have that switch either.
Well, I don't want the switch, and it's not to get too far afield, but if you want to really crawl into it to some extent, is there's a body language thing there too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something anybody really ever talks about, but like the way that I feel comfortable standing and positioning is that way. And that's, mm-hmm. that has merit, because like if you're completely sort of discombobulated and doing things backwards, it's like coming into my figure eights and everything, I have smoothness, and that's just sort of like this even goes to like you said hunting earlier. You have guys that are right eye, left eye, right or left eye dominant.
Yep.
And I'm blind as a bat, but I'm left eye dominant. So my body language is actually skewed that way, where my left shoulder's off and forward. So it's comfortable. I mean, I know, not trying to add more to the mix on picking your rod and reel, but you know, if you're a savvy angler, you got to consider that too, you know, on what
you know,
your body,
it's the
body
same,
language.
It's, I know, you know, we could talk about this. We could have a whole blog,
I could have a whole blog
or a whole podcast on this. You know, it's just like, you know, and you know, both of us playing guitar, it's you're absolutely right. It's having your dominant arm as your fretting hand. You know, that dominant hand on the fretboard to me is key. And yet, you know,
okay,
we better move on.
I've got to give one tip though, because I'll save an extra question for me and Chas, because I'm going to give everybody a tip here. Okay, and this is the Joe Booker, Steve Paul Music Hour. Apparently, here's the deal. One thing that I do with clients that really want to get dialed in, one thing I've done with myself, is there's a device called a metronome, okay? A metronome keeps musical time, where it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? Everybody's heard those little things go back and forth. You can train your non-dominant hand by keeping in time with that. So even if you're not a musician, if you think about how glide baits, jerk baits works, it's a timing thing, you can actually use that during the day. You could sit there at work or in your truck or whatever, and if you can keep your non-dominant hand in time, you can train it to fish better. So
when I send you some of these lead tracks for you to edit for me for the TV show, when I leave the click track on, that's the click track.
Yeah, it's a... Well, okay, here's the other thing. That's how I fish my gliders. So if you're hearing that, I mean, sweep.
That's why you're such a killer bass player.
Bop.
Man, you can do all that slap bass and all that stuff because you have such great timing.
But you wait till I get behind them drums at Blues Fest, you're in trouble.
That's insane. I can't believe you can play that too.
Forget questions. Here's the deal for me with musky fishing, and we're crawling down the rabbit hole, but this is the fun of this stuff, is it's all about timing, and it's all about when to extrapolate. Right? It's jazz, because like you're trying to keep these things in pop, pause, but it's like, how much do you get outside of rhythm? Does that make any sense?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is you and I've talked about that. I've talked about this in blogs. You're going to work a jerkbait.
Yep.
Rhythm. You know, the guys that really struggle with that, especially like a slack line technique, you know, that's a jazz technique.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, you got to learn to, you got to learn to let that line slacking and then hit the slack out of line. You know, and I've seen guys work some of these glide baits where they just can't get it in their brain to create some slack.
Yeah.
And therefore, when they drive a lure into the weeds, whether it's a glide bait or even a crankbait, they can't get the weeds off the lure because they keep the line too tight.
I'll move on to the next question with this quote from Miles Davis. Music is the space in between notes. How many times do you catch a muskie on the pause? I'll just leave it at that. The space in between notes. All right. Oh, my God. We just lost so many listeners. Okay. Megan L., what's the longest you've gone without a fish? How many fish in between trips? I'll let you answer that because I don't want to answer it. I'm kidding. You go for it.
The longest I've gone without a fish, well, I'll tell you, when you go on the wrong waters, mm-hmm. which are the right waters in some cases, when I go on one of these, when I have taken these pioneering trips on some big musky, like when I was fishing Georgian Bay, French River, Lake Huron, mm-hmm. Back in the day. I'd go a whole week without one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go a whole week with, I catch other fish.
Right.
You know, I stumble on a lot of big pike and stuff like that. But, you know, when I'm bass fishing, I expect numbers. I expect to catch fish and I expect to catch numbers. And a bad day, I'm still catching some.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty much anything else I talk about. I'm thinking about, you know, I'm thinking about not just catching a big fish. I'm always thinking, you know, scoring and finding a school of fish.
Mm-hmm.
But musky fishing, when you're looking for one big fish, especially on big trophy water, going without a fish a day or two is not uncommon for me still at this time. And when I
not a big
you know,
deal.
When I go on Lock Sewell, for example, I've gone a whole week without a fish.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone a whole week without a fish on many of those early, you know, Lake Huron, Georgian Bay, French River trips. So, you know, it's somewhat, you know, and I'll tell you know, so again, so we don't go too far down the rabbit hole, but I tell you, conditions, populations of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And conditions have an awful lot to do with your success. And one thing you always have to remember is that, you know, one of the biggest mistakes anglers, and I've had this discussion with many anglers over time,
mm-hmm.
you know, well, they got to eat. No, they don't. Think about
no.
it. Okay, this is one of those Booker statements that, yeah, I really don't care if anybody argues with me about
right.
it because, you know, I've got this life of experience, but
right.
it's logic. You can't compare a warm, a cold-blooded creature with a warm-blooded creature.
No.
You can't compare the two. You look at a mammal, you know, you've seen some of the photographs, you know, me filming, you know, some of these foxes and fishers and all these mammals and deer and whatever.
Yeah,
they got to eat. They're one blooded like we are. They're on a food schedule. They're on a meal schedule,
right?
Just like we are. And they, you know, that they have to eat. But cold blooded creatures like fish do not have to eat. And you know, they one of the coolest things I've ever watched and I've also read about is these studies about sharks and why.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this. Why have sharks basically gone unchanged from the beginning of time, you know, when sharks first appeared, whenever that is, you know, way back to, you know, prehistoric times when there were, you know, maybe the only thing that's changed with sharks, they were big. There were some bigger ones.
Right.
Way back, you know, the Carcharodon megalodon, which was the giant, big,
yeah,
like a three times the size of a great white. But the shark has physically is gone unchanged all those years. Why? Because it's mastered metabolism.
Yes.
A shark can go a long time without eating.
Yep.
And you know, fish in most of these bodies of water, they can adjust their metabolism by where they live and where they lay in the body of water. And so they are much more, I shouldn't say victims, but they're much more, you know, they're dependent upon the conditions and the environment they live in and the time of the year. And so, you know, think about a mosquito.
Yeah.
A mosquito is not active in January.
Nope.
You know, and it, you know, so
oh, you look at, God, look at these big snakes.
Here's the argument.
They go months.
Exactly. Think about the Dobie mosquito. Well, it's got a bite. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Mosquito is going to bite a lot better in July. He's going to bite you.
Yeah, if you want to get mosquitoes, go to Canada in July. I can promise you, they'll be biting. They'll be
That's
biting.
Right.
They'll be biting.
However,
hot and heavy.
You'll go ice fishing in January in Lake of the Woods, and you're not going to see mosquitoes.
Right.
Same thing with fish.
Yeah, they're way more. That's, I mean, not to go off that tangent, it's like, you got to watch in fishing, giving things anthropomorphic qualities. You know, that's imbuing these animals with humanistic traits.
Yep.
Because we're not really that great in the outdoors.
You know? It's like, and you know what? And one last thing about that falls into that question that we're talking about with, you know, how long did you go out without a fish? You got to understand too is that most anglers think feeding windows are huge, and they happen multiple times throughout a day.
Right.
And when conditions are good, you know, you'll get multiple feeding windows, and those feeding windows tend to be larger. But under most conditions, you know, especially weaker conditions or bad conditions, that feeding window is tiny. And the only way you arrive at a good feeding window and score on, for example, a big muskie is a cast in the right spot in that moment, like right after sunset, for example. You fished all day and you had one little change in the environment, the sunset or the moon just rose, or the wind died down, or you know, a storm is approaching, and that a weak front or something, and that feeding window was minutes.
Right.
Minutes. That's it.
And that was, yeah. And if you weren't casting, if you're sitting down eating a sandwich, you're not going to get him. Well, well, let's roll. We got one more question. I'll drag you through one more here. If folks, if you're listening for this week's episode, I'm going to be out of town. So we will get to every other question. Me and Chaz will do another gigantic Q&A for you next week. But the last one is Bob K. Bob says, what are the most important features of a boat, outboard, and trolling motor? What characteristics of a boat would you say are essential? What's nice to have, and what features are annoying? Sorry, we never pre-read these. I love them. And you said what features are annoying. So what's the most important features of your boat and your outboard and all that stuff?
Well, I think it's important to note that a skilled angler, that an angler that has those attributes I talk about, the three attributes, you know, the knowledge of the water and the skills and the effort, that angler can catch fish off the shore in a pond. He or she can catch those fish in any boat anywhere.
What do you always say? I could catch them out of a bathtub is what he says to me. Yeah,
that's right. You've heard me say that, you know, and you know, Beth, my wife and I were looking, you know, we were on a vacation right before the coronavirus thing hit here, and we're looking out at this private pond, this big pond in this, when this place we're staying in Florida, and she says, so, you know, you never fish this, it's a big pond.
Right.
She says, you know where they are? So I know exactly where they are. You know, and I pointed right over there. I said, you know, there's the main point in the lake. You know, there's one cove right there. I said, the rest of the lake is, you know, is featureless. There's sun's baking in that spot. I says, if you put the $100 bill on the table, I says, you're going to lose it because I'm going to go over there and catch fish off.
Yeah,
spot.
It's not a,
you know,
it's
yeah.
not
but,
a bet know, I would take against you. Yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying? It's just knowledge still is key. So with that being said, okay, here's your things I love. If I'm setting up a boat, here's our things I really want on the boat. You know, trolling motor wise, you know, I'm definitely one of those converts, and you are too, to the electronic steering. I'm totally in on automatic stow and deploy. I love the Altera, Minn Kota Altera. I was not a fan in the past only because I was scared of reliability. Everything else about it I thought was fantastic technology because the Altera combined with today's sonars that have side imaging, you know, especially now the Minn Kota and the Humminbird system, you know, they you know, of course they're compatible and they integrate. So that, you know, that those two things, an integrated trolling motor with a sonar unit, are absolutely key. And what's driving that boat depends on how big a water you're fishing, you know, and how big a boat you've got. But, you know, if you get me on a deck that's got those two things, then, you know, things are really going to happen, because with the electronics throw and deploy, what most people don't realize with these electronic stow and deploy trolling like the Altera, beyond saving your back, one of the key features of electronic stow and deploy is trim.
Mm-hmm.
So you're coming into shallow water, you see a rock, for example, or stump, and oh boy, I'm going to hit. When you got it, when you have manual operation, even electronic steering, but you have manual trim, you have to reach over. Unscrew that wing nut and move that trolling motor up and down, or you're going to hit. And then once you moved it up, once you get past it, you know, you're blowing bubbles. You got to reset it. With automatic stow and deploy trolling motors, you have a automatic trim switch under, and you can just move your foot over and trim up or trim down in a split second. You have moved your trolling motor up and out of danger, and when you need to dig that trolling motor deeper because you're fishing in a chop, you just hit it down and down the trims to wherever you want it. That's a fantastic feature. The other thing about these electronic trolling motors today, folks, is spot lock.
Oh yeah,
spot lock. Steve uses it. I use it. Chaz, all these guys are using it.
I was ragging him the other night, Chaz, because I know you're listening. I was trying to tell him. I was like, dude, you got to get one. Because he's still rocking the manual, which I get it. They're expensive for anybody listening. I don't have the auto up and down because there is an expenditure there. You can survive without it, but it's way better with, you know.
It is.
I kill my back guide.
Spot lock is key. You know it.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, folks. Spot lock is key in so many situations.
It's changed fishing,
dude. As a musky angler, they're dynamite. Because you get a big wind, big blow. You can get on the upwind side of a reef now. Mm-hmm. Without danger, you push spot lock. And you can just sit in place, get on the back of the boat, and two guys can just fling baits at these fish. You have an anchor out there. You have a GPS lock spot. You are not going to move no matter what the conditions are. Gusty winds, anything, it's not going to move. And as you will see in the episode that Steve and I were on just a couple weeks ago, we had a really bad blow. I hooked that big pike. My foul hooks is big pike. I'm fighting it forever. Of course, we shortened that battle up, the battle was really long. But anyways, we were blowing into rocks, and so I gunned the trolling motor out quick, hit spot lock, and it's a safety feature. Mm-hmm. If you're going to take photographs of a muskie after you catch it, and you're in a windy spot, and you want to get, you know, photos right on the spot, you hit spot lock. You don't have to worry about if you need to re-rig a lure. To re-rig a lure. In the past, it's a major catastrophe to re-rig a lure on a windy spot.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's not anymore. You just hit spot lock and you're there. To answer the questions, spot lock, electronic GPS technology trolling motors are the deal. And if you get one that's compatible with excellent sonar equipment, man, you got it. Those are two things. I don't know if we need to talk about anything.
Well,
else.
I would just interject one thing, because he's asking about motors and everything. And the one thing I would say is, like, because I was so impressed, like your Evinrude E-Tech.
Yes.
Is, and you know me, I'm cheap. I don't have a fancy, huge, gigantic boat or anything like that. But, you know, I've got a nice boat. But the thing for me is, like, reliability. Like, I don't care what the boat is. Like, I need my trolling motor and my engine to work. And that's the thing with those E-Tech motors of, like, you know, you ran over all Lake of the Woods. Man, we run hell and half acre on, like, hardly any gas.
Well, if you want to get into the outboard game, you know, I'm a gigantic fan of, you know, the Evinrude E-Tech G2. Mm-hmm. And because it's the same thing. It's got all that technology in it. And it's the most fuel efficient outboard, fuel efficient and emission efficient outboard ever made. And on top of that, it's got these same, like, you know, these same technology features. For example, one of the key things, you know, the answer to this guy's question, and add that if you want to add the outboard into the game, One of the things I love about the E-Tech G2, above and beyond its efficiency in both fuel and emissions, is iTrim. What's iTrim? You don't have to trim your engine.
Yeah.
You don't have to trim your engine if you don't want to. If you're spot running from, if you've got 10 spots in front of you, and this is really critical on, for example, these spots like on Lake of the Woods or any Canadian waters where you're doing a lot of running, quick fishing in spots, and you're going boom, spot, boom, spot two, boom, spot three, and so on. You don't have to trim the outboard down, fire the engine up, you know, trim it back up, and then do the same thing to the next spot, the same thing all day long. iTrim does it all for you. So, you know, you just fire the engine up, put it in gear, and if you don't touch the trim switch, it will iTrim. It will automatically, electronically trim your outboard for perfect performance, especially on these short runs from spot to spot. That's a feature that makes that outboard just fantastic. So that's one of the reasons one of the many reasons I really love the Evinrude G2.
Well, I mean, and that you put a good troller and a good motor on just about any haul and you're good to go. You know,
it's just,
you're going to have that reliability. And before I shut up here, the one thing too on that E-Tech that I like, because I'm jealous of that your engine, is that mid-range response too, which is really
mid-range
nice.
Mid-range power.
Yeah.
That would be the next thing to talk about. But yeah, you know, all the outboards have good top end. The four strokes, you can argue about, oh, I don't have to put any oil in. You have to put so little oil in it in these E-Tech. So it's like, it's laughable.
If you're my four stroke where I guide on it, I'm adding oil all the time. It's sort of six, one half dozen another, man.
Well, here's the thing. You know, the E-Techs have the whole shot power that is just, it's legendary. It literally will destroy.
It'll pin you to the wall.
It has a G-force.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the biggest thing with the E-Tech is the mid-range power. When you're running big waves, you're running into big waves, and you have to set that outboard somewhere in that, you know, for me, it's like that 2,800 to 3,200 RPMs. Uh-huh. And you're getting that outboard, but you're in the mid-range, where most outboards, when you put them in the mid-range, you know, they don't, you know, they back off. You have to adjust. Yeah. You have to push up on them. And then, you know, you get up on plane, then you come back a little bit so that you're finding that sweet zone where you're not getting beat up by the big waves, but they won't stay there. The G2 will stay there in the mid-range and give you that power in the mid-range. And because it's electronic throttle, it will stay there exactly until you move it. It will stay, the power will stay right there. It will not start to decrease. And I think that's that's another feature on that. So, you know, I
know we could go for days on.
Heck, I could do a whole podcast.
I guess the thing I'd say is this: if you want to learn more about it, and it's a shameless plug here, but call Brian up at Premier Power Sports. He can talk your ear off about these. That's Joe's, the guy that rigs Joe's boat and puts everything on there and does those E-Techs. But man, well, we've been gabbing here for a minute, Joe. I'll let you wrap it up here and we'll move on to another podcast, but thank you so much. And just give them your final thoughts, man.
Well, you know, it's one of the great things about Muskie 360 is you and I, when we put this app together, we're trying to take our friends, our anglers, our app users to another level as an angler, giving you guys information, education, and entertainment. And you're going to get the entertainment when Stephen Paul is the host. And we're giving you the education. You see, we've got a great group of people that we work with in the industry. And, you know, information, it's all there. And so we appreciate you being part of Muskie 360, and I know I'm just excited to be part of this whole thing. And let's stay safe out there, and hopefully the muskie season will be upon us and this coronavirus will be behind us, and we will have a great fishing season.